House Committee on Judiciary come to order. Today is March 5th, 2009. We're going to kind of go out of order today. The first item is a work session on House Bill 2303.
Chair, members of the committee, House Bill 2303 comes to you from the Oregon State Bar. You have the diaspora amendments in front of you. They replace the bill. You may remember the last time this bill was before us on the 18th of February. You directed the interested parties to go down to the Legislative Council's office and work in some language because they were basically in agreement, except for some minor details, which they did. I believe the parties are either supportive of the bill or neutral. I was told by the representative of the banks and the collectors that they were neutral on the bill. You have the diaspora amendments in front of you. What they basically differ from the original bill is in the sense that they no longer apply retroactively. They apply prospectively. There is an ability for a creditor to cure within 30 days. It requires the service member and the service member civil to notify the creditor that they are in active duty. They are protected by the Service Member Civil Relief Act, and it gives the creditor 30 days to basically say, okay, it can cure the issue and abide by federal law. It also requires the service member to state their name, to send by certified mail return receipt requested a written demand, and they are required in general language to give a general description of what the claim is. Chair, members of the committee, that is basically the differences between that and the original bill. You'll see in page 5, section 4, that this applies only to conduct that violates the Service Members Civil Relief Act occurs on or after the effective date of 2009, and the bill does have an emergency clause, Mr. Chair, members of the committee.
Okay, thank you. Is there any discussion about that from anybody?
Any motion?
No, this is
works. It's a good bill.
Good bill. Okay.
Are we in a work session?
We are in a work session.
In a motion to adopt the dash force?
Yes.
Mr. Chair, I move that we adopt the dash force to House Bill 2303.
Representative Cameron moves we adopt the dash force to House Bill 2303. Is there any discussion? Any objection? Hearing none, so ordered. You should carry
Mr. Chair.
When the time comes.
Mr. Chair, I move House Bill 2303 as amended to the House floor with a due pass recommendation.
Representative Cameron moves House Bill 2303 as amended to the floor with a due pass. Any discussion? Take the roll, please.
Representative Barton?
Aye.
Representative Cameron?
Aye.
Representative Garrett?
Aye.
Representative Krieger?
Aye.
Representative Olson?
Aye.
Representative Shields?
Excused.
Representative Smith?
Aye.
Vice Chair Siegler?
Aye.
Vice Chair Whitman?
Aye.
Chair Barker?
Aye. Motion carries, and I'd like
Thank
Lieutenant
you.
Colonel Wisnant to carry that bill, please.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Thank you. Thank you, guys, for working that out.
I was going to ask you what he voted on.
Say, what was it?
That was my
teach you to walk in late.
Yeah. I had to do a book at my library.
I still want to go. I want to go out and work on that. Sounds a lot better.
Just vote quick and we'll be done.
Just vote quick. Yeah, God.
We'll go back to the top of the agenda. And the first item is Senate Bill 86.
Chair, members of the committee, Senate Bill 86.
Public hearing. I say open public hearing.
Okay. Comes to you from the governor's office for the State Department of State Police. Chair, members of the committee, it requires the governor to determine the security requirements necessary to safely carry out the extradition of a person from another state.
Mr. Chastain.
Why would you have the governor?
Good afternoon, Chair Barker and members of the committee. My name is Glenn Chastain. I'm with the Oregon State Police, currently assigned out of our gaming division. I'm here today in support of Senate Bill 86. Senate Bill 86 simply makes some statutory changes to conform to what is actually being done today in regards to extraditions. The bill will simply revise a statute which currently requires the Superintendent of Oregon State Police to determine the security requirements and the amount of officers that are necessary to carry out extraditions of people back into the state of Oregon.
This authority has not been exercised by the Superintendent of State Police
and has been and is the responsibility of the extradition officer out of the governor's office. This bill relieves the Superintendent of State Police of this statutory requirement and is not within the scope of his actual duties. There is no physical impact to this bill, and I'm happy to answer any questions if you should have any.
Any questions from the committee? Hey, thank you. I accept a motion to move Senate Bill 86 to
work session.
Close the public hearing and open the work session.
Mr. Chair, I'll move Senate Bill 86 to the House floor with a due pass recommendation.
Cameron moves House Bill, Senate Bill 86 to the floor with a due pass. Is there any discussion? Call the roll, please.
Representative Barger?
Aye.
Representative Cameron?
Aye.
Representative Garrett?
Aye.
Representative Krieger?
Aye.
Representative Olson?
Aye.
Representative Shields?
Excuse.
Representative Smith?
Aye.
Vice Chair Stiegler?
Aye.
Vice Chair Wisnant?
Excuse.
Chair Barger?
Aye. Motion carries. Would this be okay to the consent? Any objections? Okay, Ben. We'll put that on the consent calendar. Close the hearing. Work session. Before I close the work session, Representative Wisnant.
I'll vote yes. Is there one vote?
Yes.
Thank you, Mr. Thank Chair.
You can just
close the work session.
Pull it.
Yes. Yeah. You just raised taxes across the board.
I asked Representative
Krieger. On your house, Mr. Chair.
Open a public hearing on House on Senate Bill. Gotta get used to saying that. 235.
Senior members of the committee, Senate Bill 235 comes in the estate planning section of the Oregon State Bar. You have a set of amendments in front of you. Basically, this bill raises the limits on the value of property as it relates to small estates. So it would mean that you wouldn't have to go through the formal probate on amounts that are greater than they currently are now.
I'm having trouble reading the name. Penny.
Committee. My name is Penny Serrurier. I'm an attorney at Stoll Reeves in Portland. I'm a partner there, and I've been practicing law for about 16 years. I'm the chair of the Oregon State Bar Estate Planning Section, and the section is comprised of over 1,000 attorneys who practice in the area of estate planning, and one of our jobs is to make estate planning and probate procedure efficient for our clients. The bill before you accomplishes that. The current statute allows for assets to pass without a full probate process if the value of the personal property of the decedent is $50,000 or less than $50,000, and if the real property owned by the decedent is less than $150,000. We had originally proposed that those amounts be raised to $100,000 for personal property and $250,000 for real property. After, when we drafted this legislation, it was over a year ago. The economic climate was different from what it is today. In addition, over the past several weeks, the executive committee has met a couple of times and discussed this, and we received feedback from several members of our section. And the executive committee voted to amend the proposed changes such that personal property could now pass without a full probate at $75,000 or less. Real property could pass at $200,000 or less. We believe the section committee believes that this will add efficiency to the process that decedents have to, and family members have to go through when someone passes away. And we urge you to move this bill with a due pass recommendation.
Thank you. Any questions? Representative Stigler.
Yeah, I just need some clarification. There's been a change from the $100,000 down to $75,000 on personal property?
Correct.
Do we have a
personal property including, just for clarification, personal property including tangible personal property, bank accounts, stocks, bonds.
All right. And I have a follow-up.
Please.
I had an email from a constituent on this bill. Pardon me. If somebody else has a question real quick, I'm sorry. I'm going to make sure.
Yes, Representative Barton.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Penny, thanks for coming down. It's nice to see you again. This question, I suppose, is not specific to this bill, and as you know, I don't know anything about probate, but I am told that actually the administration of estates and probate in Oregon is comparatively expensive in Oregon and California relative to, say, Washington. Is that accurate? And if so, I wouldn't mind, maybe we could communicate later if there's a way that we could prudently address that.
Chair Barker, Representative Barton, thank you for the question. In my experience, probate in Oregon is relatively easy and inexpensive compared to California. It is not as efficient as Washington. Washington uses what's called a non-intervention process, so there's very little court involvement in the entire probate proceeding. It's much more almost like a small estate affidavit process than it is a full probate. So the committee has talked about possibly moving to a non-intervention method for probates, but it will take a lot of political will to get that to happen, but I would be up for that if if you were up for that. This is a nice compromise. For many of our clients who organize their estates through revocable trusts, it's very easy to leave something outside of your trust. And if you leave something outside of your trust and it's worth more than $50,000, if it's personal property, then you trigger a full probate. And that's really the biggest issue for most of our clients, because then you incur anywhere from $5,000 to $8,000 in attorney fees and court costs just to get that $55,000 bank account transferred. So this bill addresses that issue.
I have mine. Okay. This was a concern from an attorney in Bend, and his concern was that under the current scheme of things, there are some banks and credit unions, and he's an attorney who does probate work.
Mm-hmm.
Some banks and credit unions will not accept a filed affidavit to release funds from a decedent's account or allow the affiant to cash a check payable to either the decedent or the decedent's estate. And further, he has a concern regarding title insurance companies who charge high rates if there is a deed or claiming successor in the title chain.
Yes, Chair Barker, Representative Stigler. I should tell you that not everyone in the estate planning section is in agreement with the bill. Our opinion is the vast majority of practitioners are. One nice piece that this question raises is the probate process is always an option. So personally, in my practice, when I am transferring a piece of real property, mm-hmm. and maybe arguably it's worth less than the current amount of $150,000, I may decide to do a full probate simply to get it through the title insurance process more easily. So it's always an option to do a probate.
Follow up, Mr. Chair.
Follow up.
I think his point was that his concern is that this bill doesn't go far enough in addressing some of the issues involved with small estate probates. I think that's really what the sort of the seminal part. And I had answered him that I didn't believe this bill addressed those issues. I just wanted to verify that my reading of it was correct and that this isn't included as part of that.
Chair Barker, Representative Stigler, that is correct. And what this actually has done in the past couple of weeks, where we've detected that the bar practitioners are interested in this issue, we're talking about revising the statute itself, because there are places in the statute that are not clear, and you do run into bumps in the road when you take it, your little affidavit to the bank, right, and ask them to transfer the assets. And we've already gotten suggestions from people about ways in which we could modify this statute to make it more accessible.
Follow up, Mr. Chair.
Follow up.
Particularly in, the whole point of a small estate probate is to going to Representative Barton's question regarding cost, is to help alleviate some of the cost of doing a full probate. And I think the concern of some of these folks, and I know that we've gotten a couple of written testimony today, is that, if the point is to make this, an easier process, then maybe we've only gotten partway there. Just dealing with the amounts doesn't get us to the point that I think that a lot of practitioners believe is where we need to be. So I'd encourage further work.
I would agree with that, Chair. And Chair Barker, I think we're hopeful to take that on for the next session.
You might want to put that out there.
Accelerated.
No, well, you might want to put that out there to your section to make sure that, yeah.
This session.
Yes.
Quick question. I think you probably said this, but I missed it. When was the last time these amounts were revised?
Chair Barker, Garrett, I actually didn't tell you that. They were last revised in 2005.
Okay. Representative Smith.
Two sets of questions, thank you, Mr. Chair. First, for the record, can you tell us any fiscal impact this might have on the state, either yay or nay? Anything it would have, any impact it might have on collections of any debts or taxes? Any impact it might have on reducing costs to courts, etc.? Okay, related to that, costs on individuals and families, which we've already covered. My second set of questions, I forgot. So why don't you take the first one?
Chair Barker, Representative Smith. I believe the fiscal impact of this bill is zero. Certainly the official fiscal impact was, we haven't gotten the official revised fiscal impact, but the conclusion, I think, is that there is no fiscal impact. I suppose that one could argue that it would lessen the amount of court fees that have to be paid to the court. On the other hand, you're lessening the amount of work that a court has to do. There will be fewer filings, arguably, in probate court as a result of this. Was there a part B?
Yeah, if we think it's zero negligible, that's helpful. And hopefully I remember my other question after you leave the room. and I'm shocked and surprised that our students left the room during the probate conversation. I can't imagine why they wouldn't stay here and want to hear this.
Representative Wisnant.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. For us people that are not in this kind of law, is the value of property, is it the real value or the tax assessed value? How is that?
It is the fair market value.
Fair market.
Chair Barker, Representative Wiston. Fair market value. So, and the way the statute is drafted, and this is one of the areas where we want to bring more clarity to, it is the fair market value of the property, not including any mortgage debt against it.
Yeah.
So.
Follow up.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
So, did the Senate's the one that wanted to reduce the amount back down because of the recession? Is that what you said to us, sir?
Chair Barker, Representative Wisnan.
That's good.
There were practitioners, particularly those in more rural areas of Oregon, who were, I feel, rightfully concerned about protecting the rights of creditors and making sure that there is enough process when you do transfer a decedent's assets. So this comes to light most directly when a decedent has a small bank account and perhaps a house that may be worth about $150,000, $200,000. The concern that was articulated by the estate planning practitioners who had issues with our original amounts was that $250,000 was too high, and that a house, the average market value of a house in Eastern Oregon is lower than $250,000, and should we not force people to go through the full process when a significant part of their estate consists of real property?
Sorry, I have one.
The concern.
Good,
thank you, Mr. Chair. Back to Representative Garrett, ask you, how long was it before the change? You said 2005. How long was it before that one that we have these numbers?
Good question. I believe it was 2003, although I'm not sure.
Thank you.
And I confirm that.
We're just talking among ourselves. Is there some reason why we wouldn't want to index these figures in some way so that we don't need to come back every 2 or 4 years to update these?
Chair Barker, Representative Garrett, I think that that is a good idea, and I would propose that that be part of the whole reworked statute, so you wouldn't have to see us over and over again.
I'm sorry. I have one more question that came up in reading the two pieces of written testimony that we had presented to us today, and that was the it seems to be a concern about the that this will contribute to the expansion of non-legal kind of, so i.e. little shops being set up where paralegals help people do this kind of work. Have you guys done any kind of, you know, facts, figures, anything one way or the other? I mean, are there other states that have similar limits? I mean, what? And I obviously realize that this comes from people who are both interested in, I think they have an altruistic interest in making sure that people have good representation when they're going through these processes, but also people who are concerned about their own, the impact on their own practices, so, which is also legitimate.
Chair Barker, Representative Stiegler, I think that that is true. That's part of the underlying issues about raising these limits. I think rightfully so, the members of the bar are concerned that if we allow people to transfer property too easily, that there will be issues with creditors or the wrong family members will end up with the property. In my experience, I have never encountered fraud issues or problems with conveyances other than banks or title companies using the small estate affidavit process. I believe that almost every state offers some exception to the full probate process. And the amounts, when we looked into this issue, it's been, again, about a year and a half now since we were doing our research on this amount, but they were right along, they were, my recollection is they were right in line with where Oregon's is. Many states are shifting to more of a non-intervention process, which, again, is what the state of Washington has, which is less attorney involvement, but still seems to, certainly less court involvement, and still seems to work very well there. One of our committee members last week contacted us, a few practitioners in Washington, to inquire about some of the concerns that had been raised on this very issue, and reported back that none of those issues have come to play in Washington.
Thank you.
Anecdotally.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Ma'am, you mentioned that some of the lawyers in Eastern Oregon were concerned about creditors as it related to home, real property. But my assumption would be if you were owed a debt relating to real property, you'd have some kind of lien or mortgage on that property, would you not? So what would
Chair
their
Barker,
concern be as it relates to the property?
I believe the Chair Barker, Council Taylor, I believe the concern relates to the estate overall and the fact that a person may have, let's say, credit card debt. And you're exactly right that if there's a creditor who has an interest in the real property, that creditor's interest is protected vis-a-vis a mortgage or a line of credit lien, but or a trust deed or some form of like that. But a general debt of a decedent. I believe this is where the concern is coming from, that if we allow family members to use a process that's too simple, it could potentially let them get away with not giving adequate notice to creditors. The small estate affidavit process right now requires you to give notice to creditors. So in order to not give notice, you would be committing fraud. But that's the concern, that there is so little court supervision with the small estate affidavit process that there could be rightful creditors of an estate who are defrauded. Now, as that relates to smaller towns versus, or you know, Portland, I think the issue is everywhere if you're talking about creditors. I think the feeling from the practitioners in the smaller towns is they tend to have lower real property values and less money overall, and so more people are going to be able to use this small estate affidavit if we raise the limits to an extent that's too high. And this is in part why we responded and said, you know what, $100,000 is too big of a jump right now on real property values, and cut our increase in half.
You have one more?
Just for the record, Representative Garrett asked my question about the indexing and would put on the record that if we, I think that would be really smart for us to consider.
Okay, thank you. Next, Mr. Casey, please.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Distinguished committee members, I'm Bob Casey. I'm an attorney from Portland. I'm a solo practitioner. I've practiced law for 25 years. I'm a former legislative counsel for the Alaska Legislature and also a former committee member of the estate planning section of the Oregon State Bar. Probate is the dominant part of my law practice and has been for the last 13 years of my profession. And I'm here to tell you that right now, in a parallel universe, the year is 1912. A board of directors is meeting. The CEO stands and reports to the board, "I have good news. We've shaved 3% off of our operating budget." The board, ever skeptical, says, "But what's the bad news?" And then he says, "The bad news is our entire asset base consisted of the HMS Titanic, and now it's on the bottom of the ocean. We've lost everything. The creditors have nowhere to go to be reimbursed because we're bankrupt, and we're going to have to answer to our stockholders and voters for this travesty." Now, I didn't use that number 3% carelessly. I will get into that. But I do oppose this bill for many, many reasons. Number one, it would cause a large number of estates to be mishandled. This bill should either be rejected entirely or it should be tabled until the committee has been able to examine all of the procedures necessary to correct the vast forms of abuse that will occur if this bill goes through. I'm going to outline a few of them because I realize not all of you practice probate, not all of you live in that world every day of your lives, but it's as obvious to me as the nose on my face that there are at least four massive issues that are unaddressed here. In formal probate, there is not only a requirement that family, people mentioned in the will, creditors, and the Oregon Department of Human Services all be notified. There is an enforcement mechanism behind that. The probate court will jump down the throat of the person serving as executor of the estate if they don't file proof that all of these individuals have been noticed. Now, as Ms. Cerurier said, there is a requirement that that kind of notice go out with a small estate affidavit, but there's no enforcement mechanism. When you do a small estate affidavit, and I do them often, you drop something in a wire basket at the courthouse, you pay about $75, and you're done. There is no response or monitoring by the probate clerk. No one ever notices if you mailed out notices or not. That's it. You're done. You hit the road and you do the asset transfers. Maybe the creditors, maybe the family members, maybe the people mentioned in the will, maybe the Department of Human Services with its Medicaid lien, maybe the Oregon taxpayers who have to replenish that fund, maybe they never hear about it. So notice is one issue, but it's not the only one. There's also a requirement in formal probate that a notice be published in a newspaper. That lets basically creditors know that if you have a debt against the decedent, an unsecured debt, you better contact the fiduciary quickly to get repaid, or there may be no ability for you to do so. That safeguard is gone in formal probate. The third item, accounting. If you're a family member and someone unbeknownst to you has taken charge of a decedent's estate, you probably want to know what bills were paid and why. You probably want to know what professional fees were paid and why. You probably want an inventory just in case there's something in the estate that's not being reported, that's being taken off the table and being distributed without participation by you. That is why formal probate requires an accounting. There is no accounting requirement in a small estate affidavit. That's gone. That's at the bottom of the bottom of the ocean with the Titanic. Finally, in formal probate, there's a bond requirement. It's true that someone signing a will has the latitude to waive bond if they choose to do so, but we're worried about the cases where no one ever had a will. Where no one ever had a will, and the family is caught like a deer in the headlights, any creditor, any bartender, any neighbor down the street can go to court, file one of these small estate affidavits, never have to post bond, and so if that ship ends up at the bottom of the ocean, there's no bond to compensate the injured family members. All of that exists as one of the drawbacks of the small estate procedure. So why do we have it at all? The answer is proportionality. You can say it in one word, proportionality. Safeguards are good so long as they're not so darned expensive that they swamp what's at stake. I think we would all agree that if you spend $10 to collect $9, there's something disproportionate about it. If you spend $5 to collect $10, that's probably disproportionate. If you spend $1 to collect $5, that's probably disproportionate. But what about when the administrative costs are only 3%? Doesn't that mean that the other 97% is still there? It does. It's simple math. An average-sized estate, in my opinion, if you took all estates being filed in probate courts across Oregon, threw them in a blender, came up with an average, you'd come up with a couple $100,000 as an average-sized estate. Some people die with nothing. Some people leave billions, but that's average. An average attorney fee, I know what an average attorney fee is. It's my job to do this. Not only do I look at my own fees, I look at the fees of other attorneys. I sometimes even get hired to challenge the fees of other attorneys. So I keep a very close eye on what's going on in the culture of Oregon estate planning, and I would say a typical expense, if you took all of the estates, threw them in a blender, and came up with an average, would be about $6,000 or $7,000. An average-sized estate, maybe $300,000. What does that compute to be? Maybe 3%. When you spend 3% on administrative costs, the other 97% is left. So I go back to my story of the Titanic. The good news is the company saw fit to save 3%. The bad news is they subsequently lost 100% because the safeguards weren't there. Is it really worth it when you're only talking about 3%? I don't see how that possibly passes the proportionality test. Now, earlier on, there was mention about what other states are doing. I flat out agree with Penny Cerurier that Oregon falls in the middle. If you go up to Washington, its probate procedures are quicker and cheaper. If you go down to California, they're lengthier and more expensive. And if you took the entire 50 states, Oregon would fall right on the 50-yard line in terms of whether we're lengthy and expensive or quick and cheap. We're flat out in the middle. It is what it is. Oregon is not known as one of the expensive states or one of the cheap states. It's known as one of the middle states in probate practice. There was mention about whether this would have an impact on Oregon government. It would have a big impact on Oregon government. I've talked to probate clerks around the state. They're horrified that this small estate affidavit procedure has already been expanded as far as it has because they've seen so many cases of abuse. Their offices are swamped with irate family members calling them and saying, "Why did I never hear about this?" And then they have to patiently tell these irate family members, "Well, there wasn't enough money at stake to protect you." What happens next? Those irate family members hire someone like me. because not only do I write wills and trusts, not only do I probate estates, but I litigate estate disputes, often and aggressively, because there are so many estates around Oregon that are being mishandled. It's a bad problem and getting worse. And one of the reasons why it's getting worse isn't anybody's fault. It has to do with more and more people living long enough to be frail enough to be victimized by caregivers who file small estate affidavits and take the money before the family ever hears about it. If you took the time, if you had the diligence to bring in probate auditors from around the state of Oregon and have them testify, you would get an entirely different picture of the impact this will have. If you brought in the Department of Human Services and asked them whether they wanted to make sure that that notice requirement was not only imposed by statute but enforced by a probate court, they would say, do it. Otherwise, the money is going to be taken off the table and we're not going to be able to collect it. Medicaid is going to have to be replenished from the taxpayer instead of Medicaid liens. They would say, correct that problem. Otherwise, the taxpayer is going to have to replenish Medicaid from funds that should have been replenished by estate retrieval. There's going to be a big impact because of the lawsuits. There's going to be a big impact because of the uncollected taxes. There's going to be a big impact because of the problem with Medicaid and the Department of Human Services. Finally, there was mention of whether this is in step with inflation. A lot of emails went out between members of the estate planning community and the elder law community in the last week, and I've been told that in the last 10 years, the expansions that have already been made to small estate affidavit limits have more than doubled what the rate of inflation has been. So if you want to index this, you should actually scale the limits downward, not upward. That's the kind of promiscuity that has gone into this rapid expansion of small estate affidavit limits. It reminds me of what's happened to this country in general, where we said, we don't need regulations. Human nature regulates itself. I say, no way, no way. So I'm going to go back to the ship lying on the bottom of the ocean. The White Star Line should have spent an extra 3% on safety equipment so that that ship got to New York Harbor. And formal probate should continue to exist in this state so we don't have non-attorneys using this procedure to steal families and the taxpayers from their hard-earned dollars.
Questions? Representative Garrett.
I appreciate your testimony very much. But I guess I'm left wondering why you're right and all your colleagues in the estate planning section of the bar are wrong, because they have brought us a proposal that it seems to me is actually going to work to their own economic disadvantage in many cases. What's wrong? Who should we believe here?
Do you have any proof? Does anyone here have any proof that the members of the Oregon State Bar have actually been surveyed on what they think about this? Or are you simply taking someone's say-so that everyone said, oh, this will be fine and we all agree with it? You don't know that. I don't know that. Nobody knows that. But I have talked to a lot of probate practitioners around the state, and I have watched the internet chat that has gone on the chat lines set up by the Oregon State Bar on this topic, and I can tell you a lot of attorneys don't think it's a good idea, and it's not because of self-interest. This isn't attorney bashing time. It's because estates get abused, creditors, family members get harmed, and the taxpayer gets stiffed.
Mr. Taylor?
Chairman of the committee, I've worked with the Oregon State Bar for now 12 sessions, and I've worked with the various sections, and their bills come up through a committee process. They are vetted through the bar process. They are drafted early. They are in the system early. This is the second chamber that this bill has been heard in, and we heard no opposition on the Senate side when this bill came up. And this is a normal process that we have for most nuts and bolts bills.
It's not a very good process, frankly. Members of the Oregon State Bar, most of them rank and file members, don't pay attention and don't know what's going on. They find out about it accidentally. I found out about this bill accidentally, and it's not because I'm an undiligent person. and it's not because it's really anyone's fault. But I don't think you should assume that attorneys who practice probate law in this state think it's a good idea just because you haven't heard from them. I think you should assume that most of them don't even know this bill is before you.
Representative Krieger. Mr. Chair, clear back to 2000. When did we get 2001? I guess there's nobody here from 2001, is there? That's when I got here anyway. And I've dealt with the state bar, of course, being a retired police officer. You're not sure about attorneys when you first get here. But during that 9-year period, working with our administrator here, the bar representatives going to their training sessions, I have found them to be absolutely trustworthy, never having brought anything forward that they misrepresented anything to me in any way. And because of that, they developed what I call working relationships of trust. And that is the biggest and most important thing that any lobby person can do. And they have been successful with that. I think with probably every chair that's been here, from Max Williams right on through to Mr., you know, Representative McPherson, to myself, and then on to our present chair. So be careful how you kind of, you made a comment that bothered me a little bit. And so don't impugn their motives or their, the fact that they hadn't done due diligence, because I think they do the very best they can. Oftentimes, information is available to us as legislators, and somehow we miss it because we deal with so many pieces. It's not the speaker's fault. It's not the chair's fault. It's not our staff. There's just such a volume that's out there. But I found that the bar, that people that I've worked with, I've become to appreciate them. And my entire attitude towards attorneys has changed because of that relationship.
Well, I want to apologize if I suggested that anyone had been undiligent. What I meant was, I don't think the procedure that exists, or really any procedure that any reasonable person could develop, is likely to keep the bar very well informed about this process. We're all busy people, and when we hear about a bill coming up, it happens accidentally. I'll give you a good example. A former chair of the estate planning section of the Oregon State Bar, a predecessor to Ms. Cerurier, is someone I called on the phone yesterday about this bill. Now, if he's a former member, a former chair of the estate planning section of the Oregon State Bar, you would think he would be well informed and would know about this kind of legislation. He didn't know this bill was pending. He didn't know, and not long ago, at least in terms of the structure of the Oregon State Bar, he was the leading estate planning attorney in Oregon. Now, I'm not saying that's anyone's fault, and I'm not saying even if I spent 5 years trying to dream up new procedures for people being notified, I could come up with any procedure better than what you have. But I do think most estate planning attorneys don't even know this bill is out there. It's nobody's fault. It simply is what it is. And it would be unfortunate if you assumed widespread support for this bill.
Representative Cameron.
Mr. Chair, I just want to make a comment. I think this conversation has drifted to almost a debate between different members of the Bar Association, and I want to, as a member who represents, you know, a lot of constituents, I want to go back to the facts of this bill and talk about what does it do to protect or not protect the people that I represent. And I guess I've gone all from one end of the spectrum to the other end of the spectrum and back again because of the conversation we're hearing here, but I really would like to know the merits of the bill and how it impacts the citizens of Oregon, not the professionals.
Yeah. Representative Smith.
Yeah, thank you, Mr. Chair. Appreciating Representative Cameron's comments, my own underinformed view is that probate is relatively expensive and slow, that we should engage in reforms. I don't know what those reforms should be, speaking both to you and to the bar. You know, what's the 21st century way that we should be handling the transfer of wealth from generation to generation? Maybe it's the same way we did it 300 years ago, or maybe it isn't, right? But I would at least be neutral as my assumptions of whether it is or isn't. And would hope that we would look at a range of proposals that would make sure we address debts, make sure we address taxes, make sure we're doing the fastest, cheapest, you know, most emotionally sensitive way to families who all of a sudden are dealing with huge loss, and now they've got to deal with huge, you know, sort of complex bureaucracy. So I would just like us to, in addition to addressing Representative Cameron's really important concern about this bill, I'd hope that we'd engage in a conversation about how the heck we should be doing this generally, in part just because I want to get those kids back in the room, and I know that the only way we're going to do that is we really get deep into the probate conversation.
Well, imagine, does anyone here have close family living in some other part of the country? Is that a commonly occurring part of American life now? We live in a mobile society. Suppose you have aging parents in another part of the state. Suppose this is one of you. And they die. You assume that their estate is being handled by another family member, but the days, weeks, and months go by, and you don't get very much information about what's going on. Finally, you have an attorney look into it, and you discover that without you realizing it, everything has already been transferred by small estate affidavit, and you were never notified. The attorney says, but there's a requirement under law that you be notified. But it didn't happen. Why didn't it happen? Because under small estate affidavit procedure, there's no enforcement mechanism. Has anyone looked into that yet? I mean, that's one of the defects of the procedure that exists. I can forgive it for small estates, for truly small estates, for $5,000 estates, because it gets back to the idea that you shouldn't spend $6,000 to administer $5,000 in assets. I can forgive that lack of protection for truly small estates. But what if it's you, and what if it's a middle-class estate of a dying parent on the other part of the country, and you find out a year and a half later that it's all been transferred, the statute of limitations has run, and you can't do anything about it, and you weren't notified? That's what will happen routinely if this procedure is expanded because of the kind of society we live in. So that would be my answer to Representative Cameron about how this affects not attorneys, not practitioners, not people charging professional fees, but instead you as everyday people, as citizens. That's the sort of thing that will happen sometimes. Now, it won't happen all the time. The Titanic's not always going to sink. It's going to happen a lot of the time, though.
Okay, thank you. Mr. Casey, we're not going to move the bill today. It's obviously not ready. And if we adopted the amendments, we still would have to wait for another fiscal. And what I would ask, if it's possible for you to work with the bar and see if something can be done to accommodate it, maybe that can't be done, and we'll kind of have this as a placeholder and see if we can't get something fixed for the future. So I'm not, obviously not ordering you, but just if you or some of your colleagues could work with the bar, the people who are dissatisfied, maybe you could come to some consensus.
I'm not smiling for any reason other than I realize that I was somewhat passionate in my presentation, and that may have seemed a little bit comical to you. I'll gladly work with any members of the bar that want my participation. I have worked on this in the past with the estate planning section. I was a member of that group at one point.
I was afraid the Titanic was going to rise from the bottom.
Okay, thank you very much.
All right.
Close the public hearing on Senate Bill 235 and open a public hearing on Senate Bill 237.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, House Bill 237 comes to you from the Oregon State Bar. I think this is also from the estate planning section of the bar, and this clarifies that a power of attorney may become effective at a specified time in the future upon the occurrence of a certain specified event, such as the person subject to the power of attorney becoming financially incapable. I think we probably know this in the profession as a springing power of attorney, which is not statute in Oregon, but has been often used by attorneys in the practice based on a common law argument.
Okay, Ms. Surya, please.
Thank you. Thank you again for the time. This bill is relatively straightforward, I'm hoping. In
virtually every state, you can create a power of attorney while you are competent and have that power become effective only when you, only upon the occurrence of a certain event, such as losing capacity. It's called a springing power. So when the event occurs, the power springs to life. That's the concept. The common law has long since held that springing powers are not valid, and virtually every state has overridden the common law presumption by statute or by case law. Oregon is one of the very few states left where we have not overridden the presumption. So in Oregon, a springing power on its face is presumptively not valid. So you can only create a valid power of attorney in Oregon that is essentially effective immediately. There are ways to get around this in the practice. What most of us do is create a power that's effective immediately, but then we give it to the client with a letter that says, or to the power holder with a letter that says, you can use this power only if I direct you or if you determine that I become incapacitated. The change in this statute would simply bring clarity to the law, because the reality is there are a lot of people out there who are using a springing power, and there are members of the practice, the estate planning practice, who felt strongly that it was important to conform Oregon law with the law of most every other jurisdiction in the country. So I urge you to support Senate Bill 237.
Any questions?
I have to go back and read I understood what a springing power was, used them myself, but I had to go back and cross-reference the statute that delineates the criteria and the conditions and that kind of thing. Made me a little concerned until I read that. So,
any other concerns? Any other discussion? Yeah.
Yes.
Thank you.
Thank you.
We close the public hearing on Senate Bill 237 and open a work session on Senate Bill 237.
Mr. Chair, I move the committee pass refer Senate Bill 237 to the floor with a do pass recommendation.
Representative Barton moves Senate Bill 237 to the floor with a do pass. Any further discussion? Call the roll, please.
Representative Barton?
Aye.
Representative Cameron?
Aye.
Representative Garrett?
Aye.
Representative Krieger?
Aye.
Representative Olson?
Aye.
Representative Shields?
Aye.
Representative Smith?
Aye.
Vice Chair Stigler?
Aye.
Vice Chair Wisnett?
Aye.
Chair Barker?
Aye.
Is there any objection to putting that on the consent calendar?
None.
It'll be on the consent calendar. Open a public hearing on Senate Bill 268.
Committee, Mr. Chair, members of the committee, this bill comes to you from the Oregon Judicial Department. Authorizes the Chief Justice to require persons before the court to submit data in such a way that the information supplied allows the court to distinguish one person from another. Allows the Chief Justice by rule to exclude from disclosure the information received unless good cause is shown that the information should be disclosed.
Mr. Miller, please.
Good afternoon, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. My name is Bruce Miller. I'm senior staff counsel in the Office of the State Court Administrator. I've handed out some written testimony from the Honorable Michael Marcus, Circuit Court Judge in Multnomah County. He sends his regrets. He wishes he could be here to testify on this bill, but he had an important hearing with an out-of-town expert witness that he couldn't move to come down here. This bill is part of our e-court initiative. One of the key elements of the e-court initiative is to create a person-based system so that when a judge has John Smith standing in front of him in the courtroom, the judge will be able to see whether that is the same John Smith who in another county has a restraining order against him or in yet another county has other criminal charges against him, which will allow the court to act in the appropriate manner towards that party. And it would apply both in civil and criminal, but I gave you a criminal example. What the bill does is allow the Chief Justice to create rules for this system. We're in the process of developing the e-court. We don't know what the person-based system will look like yet because we need to build it. This will allow the Chief Justice to implement rules to gather the information that's needed from the parties for the system and to protect that information because it will be personal information so that the parties remain protected after they give that information to the court. The bill passed out of the Senate Judiciary Committee without objection. It passed on the Senate floor 30-0. And thank you for taking the time to consider this for us.
Are there any questions about this? Representative Stigler.
After rereading, after our conversation yesterday, I felt better about the protections of the exchange of information. And frankly, this is one of the kind of things, there's not everything in the e-court proposal that makes me go whoopee, but this is one of those kind of things that I think it is perfectly poised to deal with and take care of, because that's a major problem is that kind of thing where you've got litigants or defendants or, you know, whatever, that have a variety of things across the state, and there's no way to coordinate that at this stage of the game. So I think this is a good step forward in that direction.
Mr. Chair, Representative Stigler, thank you. That is exactly what we're trying to get to.
Representative Krieger.
Yeah, thank you, Mr. Chair. I agree with Vice Chair Stigler. But in addition to that, some of us that have been here the last few years since the Chief Justice became our Chief Justice have seen him working with a legislative branch much more closely. We're not in silos anymore. We're communicating, and I have the greatest faith in him as far as his integrity, and that the direction he's trying to take our court is in fact where we should have gone years ago. And so I want to give him the latitude and the tools that he needs to do it.
Thank you. Representative Shields.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Bruce, I appreciate you coming to talk with me about this bill before. I'm just curious, though, as a non-lawyer, if, let's say, in making these rules, the Chief Justice does something wrong, what remedy would somebody have in the rulemaking process to challenge, say, maybe an incorrect identification, or how would that work? Do you have any sense of that?
Mr. Chair, Representative Shields, my presumption is that as we build the rules, that will be part of what goes into the rules. The rules themselves, I don't know how they'll be adopted. There's a good chance they would go into the Uniform Trial Court rules because we already have a Chapter 21 on e-filing. So they may go in there, in which case the rulemaking process goes through that committee. It's open, it's public, and we send the rules out for public comment so that people will have a chance to look for those kinds of issues to make sure they're addressed. There's also a possibility the rules could be adopted as standalone rules, but we would still follow a similar type process.
Okay. Thank you.
Any further discussion? Okay, thank you very much.
Thank you.
Close the public hearing and open a work session on Senate Bill 268.
Mr. Chair, I'll move Senate Bill 268 to the House floor with a due pass recommendation.
Representative Cameron moves Senate Bill 268 to the floor with a due pass. Is there any further discussion? Call the roll, please.
Representative Barton?
Aye.
Representative Cameron?
Aye.
Representative Garrett?
Aye.
Representative Krieger?
Aye.
Representative Olson?
Aye.
Representative Shields?
Aye.
Representative Smith?
Aye.
Vice Chair Stigler?
Aye.
Vice Chair Wizett?
Aye.
Chair Barker?
Aye. Motion carries. Representative Shields, would you be comfortable with this going to the consent, or would you like to make a statement on it?
I think consent would be a good idea.
Okay. Is there any objection to being on consent? So ordered.
Thank you for asking.
Yeah.
I thought he was going to ask.
Open a public hearing on Senate Bill 271.
Chair, members of the committee, Senate Bill 271 comes to you from the Judicial Department. Clarifies that the filing fee for petition in tax court is due at the time of filing, allows the Chief Justice of the Oregon Supreme Court to set fees for copies of tax court records, prohibits the Chief Justice from charging for the location or inspection of tax court records and other matters relating to the tax court. Mr. Chair, members of the committee.
Thank you. Mr. Miller, again, please.
Thank you.
Good afternoon, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. My name is Bruce Miller. I'm Senior Staff Counsel in the Office of the State Court Administrator. This is a housekeeping bill for the tax court. It does two things. The first thing, it amends ORS 305.490, which is the statute that addresses filing a petition in the tax court and the fact that all of the circuit court statutes dealing with filing fee are very specific that you have to pay the fee at the time you file the petition. This particular statute is not specific. There was a challenge under that. That challenge has gone to the Supreme Court. The Supreme Court said, yes, indeed, you must file your fee at the same time as the petition. That came out after we requested the bill. Nonetheless, we would like to go forward with the bill because we think it's beneficial to the taxpayers to see that in statute, so it's very clear to them that when you file your petition, you need to pay your fee then. The second part of the bill deals with miscellaneous fees. The tax court is the equivalent of a circuit court. Miscellaneous circuit court fees are set by Chief Justice order. The tax court statute that we're amending here only covers a few of the typical fees that courts see, and so we are asking for the ability to have the Chief Justice enter an order setting those fees to the exact same extent that he sets those fees in circuit court. And this would cover things like NSF checks and that type of thing.
Okay.
This bill, once like the last one, came out of Senate Judiciary without objection, passed on the floor 30-0. Thanks for considering it for us.
Thank you. Any questions? Thank you very much, Mr. Miller.
Thank you.
Close the public hearing. Open a work session.
Mr. Chair, I'll move Senate Bill 271 to the House floor with a due pass recommendation.
Representative Cameron moves Senate Bill 271 to the floor with a due pass. Any discussion? Call the roll, please.
Representative Barton?
Aye.
Representative Cameron?
Aye.
Representative Garrett?
Aye.
Representative Krieger?
Aye.
Representative Olson?
Aye.
Representative Shields?
Aye.
Representative Smith?
Aye.
Vice Chair Steeler?
Aye.
Vice Chair Wisnant?
Effective date of the 7th. Need effective date.
Mr. Chairman, is it be on the bill? Mr. Chairman, is an effective date? There's none on here, so it'll be January next year. There's no emergency.
Yay.
Yay. Chair Burke.
Aye. Motion carries. Once again, is there any objection to consent calendar?
Nope.
So ordered. Before we go, I'm going to reopen the work session for the purpose of voting on House Bill 2303. Representative Shields, how do you vote?
Aye.
Close the work session on 2303. On opening a work session on Senate Bill 86. Representative Shields, how do you vote?
Aye. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Work session closed on Senate Bill 86. Any further business before the committee today? Adjourned.